This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 18th of August 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to episode 215 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
On the show today, we'll be talking to the man behind the sixth most visited website in the world, Wikipedia. Jimmy Wales tells us about his journey as an entrepreneur and shares his views on the often tricky relationship between government and transparency.
We'll also be talking to the director of a new documentary called The Wrecking Crew, a look at the unsung session heroes behind some of the most iconic music from 60s LA.
And as the Swedish are busy organising crayfish parties this month, we obviously treat ourselves to a bucket or two. That doesn't sound very nice, does it? At the end of the programme.
That's coming up in the next hour. Plus, Tom Edwards will be here with the news look ahead. We might have time for some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. So we're meeting the man who's made the sixth most visited website in the world, Andrew.
I discovered, actually, during the introduction to that, that sixth and actually the word introduction are quite hard to say.
They are quite difficult to say. There's two ways to take this. What do we do? Do we ask our researchers to try harder and get us the fifth, fourth, third, second and first?
Or it does beg that question,
do we
doesn't it?
Ask each other what is in our history cache on our work laptop?
Luckily, I've learned to delete mine before I go home, just in case.
Before you go home, man alive. I think that's the thing, isn't it? It's like if Wikipedia is the sixth, I mean, there are some things that you have to fact check that sometimes, you know, could turn the stomach.
Well, what's really interesting is you have actually Aled John's laptop.
Should we look at it now?
Should we have a look to see what his history is?
Okay, here we go. We're on the history. Aled is the producer of today's show. Lots of people who listen to the more newsy programmes Section D, which he hosts.
He kindly let us borrow his laptop.
Okay, so we've got Facebook top.
Facebook top.
One musician at a time. That's clearly like a music porn website. One musician at a time. Can't keep you all entertained at once. Jeff Wenzel. I don't know who that is. And then actually, it rather sadly does look like things like Gmail, Twitter. There's not things that actually you might actually genuinely interact with. That's a bit of a shame. Well, Facebook number one.
Yeah, it's good that he checked that just before he came on the show.
Exactly.
Just in case there was a late breaking story.
Exactly. So that's what we've got to look forward to. And what were you talking about buckets for? You made some pun about buckets, Andrew. I'm not entirely sure.
It's not a pun. It's just I'm not sure it's the most kind of appetizing description of crayfish. Would you like some crayfish? Would you like a bucket of crayfish? It makes me feel more like a sea lion than a person.
It makes you feel like you've been eating at KFC.
Yes.
Or something like that.
Or a SeaWorld.
I can't wait later in the show to sort of rehash the lobster scene from Annie Hall in the kitchen with you, Andrew. It's going to be some awkward sexual tension. We're going to have to... Probably one's going to go behind the fridge and we're going to have to fish it out.
But my favourite bit in that film is when he then tries to reenact it with, obviously, the next girlfriend.
Yeah.
It just doesn't go so well.
It doesn't work. Exactly. That'd be like you, maybe next week if you're doing the weekly with someone else.
Well, actually, am I here next week? I've got a feeling both of us... Well, you're...
I think I'm going to be back, actually.
Okay.
My little...
Well, we'll hold on to your seats. Anyway. I'm sure people are super excited hearing about our planning schedules.
Next week, we'll be doing Marcus Hippie's History Cache on his laptop computer. Stay tuned.
Well, anyway, that's enough from us here at Midori House for the moment, because now it's time to turn further afield with Tom Edwards and the news look ahead.
Yes.
Keeping you in the loop and on the ball, this is Tom Edwards with his weekly look ahead.
And Tom Edwards, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. It's been a while, Crocodile, have we been?
Yeah, not too bad, thanks, Rob. You're looking fine, Fatal, and Andrew, you too.
Good, and you too.
Oh, that's great. Okay.
Good, that's that section finished. Let's eat some crayfish.
I'll see you next week.
What's on your look ahead? And by the way, while your theme music was on, you turned your piece of paper around with your news stories on it, and you've written look ahead with two I's for the O's in look. I like that. I haven't seen that done since like a sort of joke book I had when I was a kid.
I like to go back for vintage comedy. And I've also written look and then ahead underneath, and I've made the E of ahead, into the smiley mouth with teeth. So it's like a little happy face.
Okay. With teeth.
With teeth. Okay. Smiling, though.
Good.
Well, it does look slightly sinister.
So is it a good news week this week?
Not particularly.
We're still in the silly season.
It's kind of moderately more serious season.
Okay.
Okay.
I think it's the right direction. Yeah. So Well, in fact, this is just very serious, basically. Tomorrow, the Colombian government and the FARC resume their political integration talks. This has been a kind of long process. We've charted it very much in the new edition of the magazine, of course. Our own Steve Bloomfield, on one of his valiant missions around the globe, has been following the process, which has been brokered by all sorts of other parties. It's really intriguing. But they're back around the table tomorrow, so there's been a few weeks of rest.
Is this still happening? This is in Havana, this is happening?
I believe so, yeah. But they may even manage to get some sort of conciliatory talks happening back on the home front. So, but I just think it's very interesting to chart the process. And I find it intriguing, the actual nuts and bolts of the diplomacy, which is what I guess Steve was writing about in more detail. Yeah. It's really intriguing.
One of the things I really love about Steve's story, which is in the current issue, is that he says that, in fact, they did have an attempt at these talks some years ago, which kind of seemed to go well, except the problem was that what seemed to be going well was they liked to hang out and have a drink with each other. And it meant that kind of nothing got decided. And this time the Norwegians are involved and the Cubans are involved. And it's much stricter. They keep them apart. They don't encourage them to do too much together. And there's a kind of, you know, a cutoff point at the end of the day when talks stop. And they have to stop every couple of weeks and go back to Colombia. And it's a much more strict business kind of way of doing it. And that's brought results. So oddly, it's not bonhomie that you need. It's actually just kind of good business.
And that flies in the face, I guess, of a lot of people's expectations about how you strike this kind of deal. We always talk about, you know, personalities are the most important thing, but maybe actually it's the function, the structure, and having some, if not cold, but just a bit of objectivity from sort of experts who you can ship in to take care of the business.
Some neutral Nords help you out.
Although in my experience, although we want this to be a success, what happens in Cuba should probably stay in Cuba.
That sounds way more interesting even than the weekly look ahead.
Let's move on to the next item.
We'll be back there another time, listeners. The next day, Tuesday, Al Jazeera America launching. Again, there's been some delays to this process. It's been rather drawn out, but I think it's pretty interesting. Al Jazeera, will remember, acquired this US cable channel to get their sort of market position in the US. It's going to be available across millions of households in America. And they've expanded their offices. They've recruited a lot of staff. And I think it'll be very interesting on several fronts. One will be just how they position it, both as a sort of counterpoint to the US media, which we know has a lot of very varied tendrils, and just in terms of how it evolves Al Jazeera's own operation, which obviously has been very sort of Middle Eastern focused, even despite their international reach. This kind of changes it up into a completely different dimension. I think media watchers will find both the launch and how they position themselves in the market rather interesting.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I mean, it's clearly just such a big challenge for them. You can imagine even the more liberal or renownedly liberal networks will be gunning quite vociferously sort of against them, which is kind of a tough thing. But maybe they'll come off. I always think that when, you know, a large percentage of the American population still would like to believe that Barack Obama was born in Africa or possibly in the Middle East rather than in the United States, that a channel called Al Jazeera maybe will only fly with a certain percentage and a certain level of the electorate or the sort of viewing several. But hey, we'll see what happens.
Exactly,
I mean, they've got some great people there. And interestingly, this is a story we're putting together right now for the next issue we're doing, which is October. I think Al Jazeera's focus is very much on making the US arm of their effort a success, because it's sort of a moot point in the Middle East that they might have taken their eye off their home ground, and that there are a lot of small channels in Egypt, even in Oman, especially in Lebanon, and in the UAE, that are snapping at their heels and breaking stories, maybe with a little bit more sort of competitive spirit than maybe getting the story absolutely eyes crossed and T's, eyes dotted and T's crossed. I was never very good at it.
They want to get that the right way.
But that's the kind of thing. So I kind of think even a big, wealthy parent company like that, the Doha company, kind of looking to America, possibly slightly at the expense of their original operation. But yeah, that'll be an interesting one for everyone, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure it'll be a topic of conversation later in the week on Thursday, the Edinburgh International Television Festival, of course, which we'll be covering on Monocle 24. Lots of awards. They look at the sort of British media landscape in particular, but there's always a sort of international element. And I'm sure that sort of discussion will be sort of front and centre for the people at that event. Generally, I think that sort of Edinburgh, the whole international festival, is really intriguing. That summertime, there's so much diverse media coverage, and I think the TV festival is really kind of intriguing. And we'll be watching that during the week.
On the telly.
appropriately enough. Okay. But we'll be speaking to people on the radio as well.
And why not? Have you found anything else for us?
Yeah, one other thing I thought was quite interesting. Looking ahead to next Saturday, there's the National Kurdish Conference in Erbil. And this is quite intriguing, obviously, as much for the kind of infighting and politicking that takes place within all of these different Kurdish factions. It's as interesting in that respect as it is in terms of the sort of difficulty that Kurdistan as a whole region across these various other countries, the challenges that they face. And it'll be interesting to see whether this conference, which is the sort of first of its kind, all these different representatives from all of these different factions drawn together. It's obviously quite a tense period across the region, without stating it too lightly. Turkey too, there's a great deal of still, you know, upheaval. And I think it'll be very interesting to chart the course of these different groups and find out how they respond both to their sort of internal pressures within their, you know, all the different party setups that they have, and from without as well, because obviously they're still under a great deal of pressure from, you know, Erdogan and from other regional governments to put on a sort of a coherent front that the outside world can deal with in a more coherent way.
Brilliant. Well, and no funny ones for us to end with.
That's the opposite of the silly season. But you know what?
I said it was a slightly more serious season.
Despite the smiley face, there wasn't too much to smile about.
Maybe that's why subconsciously I wrote the smiley face.
Yeah.
It was incumbent upon him to bring
Tom
to bring
Edwards
the laughs
rebranding
this week.
Serious news every week.
That was serious.
All right, Tom. Well, thank you so much for dropping in. Interesting stuff as ever. We'll see you same time next week. Our eyes, our ears will be peeled for the Edinburgh TV stuff you're doing on Thursday as well. Thank you very much.
No worries.
As a bit of an experiment now, turn to your search engine of choice, type in whatever you ate for breakfast or the model of car you drive or even your mother's city of birth, and then click enter. It's a fair bet that one of the top hits is a website you've used instinctively now for years, a website that has, unconsciously or not, become your go-to reference point on the internet for pretty much anything and everything.
If you were to gauge the success of a service on how integrated it is in your everyday life, then Wikipedia is perhaps the web's biggest winner. The man behind this, the sixth most visited website on the planet, is Jimmy Wales. And for a new generation raised in large part by the whims of the internet, what Jimmy created in 2001 is perhaps just as important as food or shelter. We're not underselling this, are we, Andrew?
Oh.
It's 30 million free articles written collaboratively by volunteer editors around the world in 287 languages. It's seen almost as much as a public service than as a real earthbound organisation with staff and a board.
Jimmy was in London recently and popped by Midori House to talk with our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, on the agenda, the current state of Wikipedia, the often tricky relationship between government and transparency, and his life as an entrepreneur.
Jimmy Wales, welcome to Markle 24.
Thanks for having me.
And I guess, as well, I should say, welcome to Marylebone.
Yes.
You're our near neighbour.
Near neighbour, that's right. Yeah, I have a flat here.
Let's talk about London a little bit. What has drawn you to live here? Because, you know, it's a city that, in terms of technology, it's we like to think it's, if not booming, at least sort of going in the right direction. But it's not a Silicon Valley yet, is it?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the tech industry here is growing rapidly. There's a cool scene with lots of cool stuff going on. But the fact that it's not Silicon Valley, I think, is to its advantage, really. I don't think there's anybody who really thinks, gosh, if only I could live in San Jose, because it's not that great. Whereas in London, you do get this amazing intellectual cross-fertilization, the kinds of different people you can meet and work with who you would never find in Silicon Valley is pretty amazing.
And talk about the sort of work that you do now. A lot of what you're doing seems to be, in a way, quite political. It's activism in a way. It's about saying, you know, it's about opening things up rather than, you know, what's the new thing that's going to make me a huge amount of money.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, I, for better or worse, I don't really care that much about money. I have a very nice life. So, and I feel this very strong sense of responsibility that for whatever reason, I can say something and it's in the news about politics. And so I can bring issues to the forefront that might not otherwise come to the forefront in at least some small way. And so that's something that I really enjoy doing. I really enjoy sort of reminding politicians that the internet really matters and you can't just bumble around. It's something I enjoy doing.
On that issue of the internet really matters, you can't just bumble around. You know, you've been doing some work here with the UK government. This government doesn't always strike me as the sort of government that really understands how the internet works. Is that fair?
Yeah, but I think that's true of all governments. And there are some really great people in the UK government and some really horrible people in the UK government relating to the internet. And, you know, this is a coalition government, but even more than that, I think it's Cameron, for better or worse, it truly is a cabinet government. It doesn't all flow top down from Cameron, but what that means is there's completely radical disconnect between different parts of the government. Some parts are very keen on technology and so forth. Others are just, I mean, would roll back the clock 15 years if they could in favor of copyright lobby and so on. So it's really, it's a mixed bag. But I think that's true basically everywhere. You know, you'll have different politicians who have different levels of understanding, or in the U.S., different levels of being paid off by relevant interests. So, yeah, it makes for an interesting environment, because just when you think, ah, oh, this is really great, I mean, the government really is doing just a fabulous job, and then you open the newspaper the next day and you see the latest boneheaded idea that they've put forward. So then what do?
Where does your activism come from? Because it's, you know, to look at your career, it doesn't, correct me if I'm wrong, but you weren't on big student protests when you were younger. That I don't get the sense that there was a sort of big idealistic young teenage Jimmy Wales who wanted to change the world.
No, there always was. And it's actually one thing that's quite interesting is that I come from, and we in the world of Wikipedia, we come from the free software movement, open source software, which has always been quite political in a small p political sense, political about issues of openness and freedom and making rational decisions and so forth. And that grows, of course, out of a deeper kind of geek culture, sort of the culture of Star Trek, you know, the sort of a rational universe with hopefully thoughtful decision making and a little bit of boldness. And that kind of culture for a long time was just within the computer industry, right? And it didn't really matter for everybody else that programmers were banging on about the importance of sharing code and so forth. But now that everybody's using the internet, issues of copyright, for example, impact all of us. In the old days, if you took a little film of your kid's birthday party, a little movie, and you sent it to grandma, you wouldn't have any, it would never occur to you to think about what's the copyright law for the music that was playing in the background. Now you make that same film and you make it for grandma and you put a little soundtrack on it. You say, this is so cute, we'll send it to grandma. And YouTube detects the soundtrack and silences your movie. And you think, well, I'm not a pirate. I'm just somebody trying to make a kid's birthday party movie. You know, it's a bit bonkers. And there's a million ways that this kind of thing impacts people. All the kinds of things that people are trying to do online. Suddenly, what we've been talking about for a long time about openness and taking cognizance of the impact of these technologies on our lives, which are not only just the simple things of like, oh, well, now I can look up a restaurant on my phone, but all the different things about who I can communicate with. These days, of course, who's tracking me? Who's watching me? How do we deal with those kinds of issues? So suddenly, issues that used to be political only within the computer science world are now impacting everybody.
And do you find that online activism, if I can call it that, then filters through to the way you see the world on other issues, whether that's, you know, whether that's same-sex marriage or whether that's, you know, the war in Syria? Do your thoughts on openness and freedoms extend to those as well?
I think I have a coherent outlook on the world, and it's a very common sort of modern techno-utopian kind of worldview, which tends to be, you know, quite small L libertarian in nature. For certain issues, I think it's probably a little harder for me to see what is the nexus between mobile devices and gay marriage. I'm a little hard to say exactly. But when you think about something like Syria, absolutely, because you're beginning to see people who've lived in very difficult, oppressive situations for a long time finally begin to be able to get organized, finally have a means to express their outrage and make change happen. And it's not easy, of course, because, you know, it's all lovely to imagine, yes, we're all going to get on Twitter and agree to meet in the square and we're going to overthrow the dictator. And that's worked a few times. And then other times he comes and shoots you all. And then you've got a really big problem. So I don't think we can be naive about these kinds of things. But there's no question that technology is impacting the world in some really fundamental ways.
Do you think that the way that we use technology is going to, at some stage, settle down? We'll work out, because it's not just governments that are trying to work out how to use technology. It's all of us, you know. How much do we share on Facebook? What do you know? How much do we say on Twitter? Which other things do we sign up to? Do you think that within a decade or two decades there'll be a moment where actually we all kind of get it now? We've worked out the limits of what we're willing to put out there, and we've maybe set up some rules to limit what else other people can put out there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we do have emerging understanding, emerging social norms. You know, we can be as simple about that as sort of the classic idea of, well, gee, college students, you might want to think twice about which drunken pictures you put on Facebook. They may come back to haunt you. That's a very simple way of thinking about it. I think much more complex and much more difficult, you know, would be questions about how much do we trust Facebook? How much do we trust Google? How much should we be thinking about using encryption to protect ourselves from being snooped on by the government or by, you know, mafia people who are trying to steal our credit card numbers and steal our identity in various ways? Those are still very much in flux and very much nobody really quite knows how certain things are going to go. And I think it's really interesting.
And to go back to Wikipedia, where does this website go next? Because it's, in a sense, it's, yeah, it's all working very well. You've got tens of thousands of editors and moderators and all sorts of other people chipping in on every conceivable subject of every second of the day, and you occasionally having to step in and try to in some way suggest which direction it should go in. Does it just keep on happening like this with the occasional fundraising drive?
Yeah, I mean, I think the essentials aren't going to radically change. We're not about to become YouTube, for example, or do anything crazy like that. I would say the two areas I would watch for change. One, we have now in beta our visual editor, and that, you know, it's another one of these cases where at first you think, all right, they're changing the editing interface. I mean, could I stab myself in the face and be more bored by such a useless technical piece of information? But it's actually quite important, because one of the things we know about the Wikipedia community is that we tend to be very largely tech geek in nature, and that implies and that brings along with it largely male. We've got a lot of computer geeks in the community, and traditionally it's been, when you click edit, it can be a bit of a learning curve. You have to learn a wiki markup language, and loads of people are geeks but not tech geeks. And so in order to diversify the community, we have this new editing interface, which is in beta now and really under fast improvement and development. And we think that's going to help us to diversify the community.
Does that mean that someone like me who, frankly, I'll be honest, if I was to click on an edit page, I wouldn't even know what half the words mean?
Yeah, you'd know what the words mean, but you wouldn't know what all the little squiggly bits mean.
Yes, exactly.
And you could learn it. I'm confident of that. But why would you bother? Like, you've got a life to live and so forth. So we want to diversify the editing community. And this, we think, will help to bring in people of different age range, people of different backgrounds, you know, more humanities-oriented geeks, more women, and so forth.
What does your current editing community think of that? When you say we want to diversify you?
They're very supportive of that concept. Again, who we are is, you know, a bunch of tech geeks, and we do come with a certain open mentality. The other large category, so there's the visual editor and the attempt to diversify, and that would be, you know, thinking about all the major languages that we already are very big in. But the other form of diversity is the growth of Wikipedia in the languages of the developing world, and that's a really key part of our plans going forward. We're in over 200 languages, but a lot of the languages in the developing world are very small. They don't have nearly the quantity and quality of content that we would have. And there's a lot of things that we're trying to do, pilot projects and experiments to see what can help with that. A big part of it actually turns out to be technical. A couple of years ago, I met with a bunch of editors in India who were explaining how they would go to this Google transliteration thing and type there and then cut and paste into Wikipedia, because our keyboard entry methods, we didn't support all the ones that they wanted. That's improved to some extent now, but that's the kind of investment we have to make. And the other element, of course, is mobile. You know, the next billion people who come online are largely going to come online for the first time using a smartphone. And so we want to make sure that not only is their reading experience very good, but to the extent possible, which is always going to be tricky on a small device, that they can participate in editing as well. So there's a lot of challenges in that area.
That was Jimmy Wales, Wikipedia's founder, speaking to Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly with me, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound.
Surf's up this summer as Monocle Films follows the wind in search of an under-the-radar beach haven for diehard enthusiasts.
Ericeira is special for its wide array of waves, beach breaks, point breaks, and reef breaks to suit a range of surfing styles and skill levels, all in a compact span of dramatic coastline. This 8-kilometer stretch of coast was named a World Surfing Reserve in 2011, and the surfers who come here can't stop raving about it.
Catch the wave in Ericeira in the Films menu on Monocle.com.
There is one dish over all others in Sweden at the moment, crayfish. One of the most important cultural celebrations of the year is called Kräftskiva, the name of the crayfish parties that take place in August. Everyone's laughing through the glass. People get together on warm autumn nights, eat crayfish, have a drink or ten, and wear funny hats. Well, that's at least what we've been told.
The celebration has been gradually spreading out from Scandinavia, and we do have a crayfish party expert also here in the kitchen of Midori House. We've been warned that Kräftskiva, I'm going to go for an easier,
but well,
no, that's not too bad, is it? It's so messy that it's wiser to do this. I was going to thought it was going to say do it naked, but it's wiser to do this outside of our studio area. And because of that, we're going to now head out. We're going to leave the studio, me and Rob. We're going to go OB style in the kitchen.
ODB. Mimi Vikardal from Stockholm Restaurant and Deli here in London. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you very much.
We're in the sort of central part of our kitchen where people tend to make their luncheon. Some people make some pretty handsome things. No one ever makes anything as good looking as this. We've got what we've got, like 9 crayfish, slightly different sizes. We've got breads, we've got what look like schnapps, we've got beers, we've got some pretty handsome napkins, and you've made Andrew and I put on some amazing bibs. So you've got to talk us through what we've got and why this time of year first.
Okay, so this time of year, because all the crayfish that died, all the Swedish crayfish died, because someone imported a crayfish from America. And this crayfish had some sort of thing on it, so it killed all the others, all our Swedish ones. So they restricted the when you're allowed to fish the crayfish to like 1 month in the end of the summer, and that was August. So then they made a big feast, like a big party, when you were allowed to eat them.
So this is a kind of an environmental story with alcohol.
Yeah.
Thank God for that. I was getting a bit sad there at the beginning. Were you, Andrew?
I was getting a little bit sad. I was a bit worried.
I was like, oh no.
So there's no religious connection. But it also happens at a good time of year. Summer in Sweden can be amazing.
Yeah.
And you still have pretty long nights at this time. Yeah. So I did actually go to a crayfish party many years ago, and it does seem to involve also a lot of singing, a lot of toasting, and quite a lot of alcohol.
Drinking.
A lot of hopper.
Depending on how much you drink, doesn't it?
I think I certainly did it. So what are we going to do? Is there a way that we need to eat this?
Yes,
there are. Order in which we need to eat this?
Because
also these things look like they need to be taken to pieces as
well.
Yeah,
you're going to need both your hands.
Okay.
Okay.
And it's a bit messy, as you can guess.
So give us a lesson in how we crack open a crayfish.
Okay, first of all, you take the crayfish.
Okay, we should do this simultaneously with you.
So we've got them upside down.
You start by sucking the juice between.
this is already starting bad.
So I've got an upside down, not that clean looking crayfish. I'm sucking the juice out of where?
Between his little legs.
Between his little legs.
Really? Go on then, let's see you do it. Really? Okay.
Salty and taste of dill.
Yeah,
it does actually.
Much nicer. I thought that was going to be like kind of armpit taste off his eight little legs.
I thought basically I was going to be licking a river. But right. Yeah.
Then you take a firm grip on his tail and twist it open like that.
Okay.
Okay, got him.
Yeah. And then if you're a brave crayfish eater, you see here, that's called the butter. It's not butter, but it's called butter. So you can open here.
Take the back of his shell off.
And you can suck there. You can try this one. Try it.
So I eat that?
Yeah.
Well, suck that or eat the whole thing? Mmm, that's pretty good.
It's good?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What about all these little... These are quite small dudes, aren't they?
Yeah.
We're not looking at the claws. So you've taken the leg off.
Yeah, take the claw. The legs are so small, you wouldn't eat them.
So you just take the claw,
then I would break it again.
Ooh, he's hurt me. I don't know whether mine's dead. I think I got a nip. Andrew.
Where do you take the little legs?
God, this is a lot of work, isn't it?
They are, right? Yeah, they are.
Where I haven't got anything yet.
I've got the Mimi's butter.
Ooh.
Sorry, that sounded wrong. I didn't mean that to sound.
I'm not quite sure about the buttery bit.
No, well, you didn't have no buttery bit in that one.
Oh, okay.
If I find one, I'll give it to you.
Okay.
Okay, I'm going to break. I'm breaking this core here.
So you break it, like, you can have, if you have a nutcracker, it's quite good if they're hard.
Okay. Yeah.
Or I would just bite it. Okay. There you go. And here's the knife, very handy. You have this little crayfish knife here.
Okay.
You can scrape the meat from the claw out and eat it.
I'm not surprised people need a drink after this. It's exhausting.
Yeah. That's just pretty good. In Sweden, where are the crayfish? Are they wild all the time? Are they in rivers? Are they in the sort of deep sea? Whereabouts do they hang out? Where do they find them?
Are they in the fridge at the supermarket?
Yeah.
Quite many are in the fridge, yes.
It's going to suck the dill on this one.
We do have Swedish crayfish, but quite many are imported from either England or quite many are from China and Turkey as well, yeah.
I mean, one of the things we've been covering a lot on Marcus Hippie's food program, The Menu, here on Monocle 24, is that a real revival in interest in, you know, really local food, Swedish traditions, you know, Danish traditions. Is this kind of event more popular than ever, the eating of the crayfish?
Yeah, I think it is. And I think, because I went to a crayfish party last year with some friends in my age, and they had maybe two crayfish each, and then they just kept on drinking and drinking. But I'm used to doing this, sit down, eat for hours and hours, and take it easy, and maybe have 20 crayfish each. They didn't do that. So I think it's becoming more of just a drinking party than a... You just have the crayfish as an excuse.
How very sad that is. I would never do that.
And we were quizzing you earlier, because you work for this deli selling Swedish food here in London, in a part of London where you said there's quite a lot of Swedish families. So at this time of year, are they all heading your way to get their supply of crayfish?
Yes, there are quite many coming our way to buying crayfish. And our head chef, Goran Land, who's also the owner of the restaurant...
I'm sorry.
That is delicious, isn't it?
It's delicious. Yeah, he boils them himself, so he does it all himself, prepares them, and
And apart from the actual crayfish, what else do people eat with them on the day?
We would eat what we got here on the table. This is a cheese called Västerbotten cheese. Västerbotten is like a county in an area in Sweden. It's quite.
It's the cheddar of Sweden, is it?
Sort of, yeah. It's It's quite like a flavor, like very a lot of flavors.
Yeah, I like the cheese. The cheese is good, and you don't have to make any weird noises while you're eating it. It's very good.
You don't have to explain anything about sucking between its legs. Just eat it.
Well, I'm sorry about that. That's why I like it less, I think.
Now, in Sweden, and I know in Finland as well, because Marcus Hippie's told us this, that a lot of still kind of traditional toasting goes along with singing and what are those toasts? Are those toasts just kind of to friends and to family, or are they more traditional than that?
No, it's more like, that's also again, like it would just be a toast as in let's drink and sing a song.
That's not much of a toast, let's drink.
No, but you would stand up and say, yeah, so let's take a schnapps and sing this song. And the toaster would stand up and sing, everyone would join in, and then you come to the end, you say cheers, and you drink. And then someone else...
So are they for specific people? Are they for friends? Do you change them? Or are they kind of traditional things that have been 200 years old, and there's always a type of song you sing? There's always a kind of specific toast?
No, I think that's more like, in that case, like whereabouts you are in Sweden or Finland. If you're in the north, I guess they have different songs than we do in the south.
Okay.
I mean, we're not going to make you sing, but if you were doing the toast bit, first of all, if you were calling on the people to stand up and make a toast, how does that sound in Swedish?
I would just be standing up and saying, okay, everyone, let's have another drink.
But in Swedish, hopefully.
In Swedish.
Oh, in Swedish. Oh, you want to do it?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
We need to learn something.
Okay, of
course. We need to listen at least or something.
Yeah, listen. I would say, kom igen allihopa, nu tar vi en ny snaps och så sjunger vi tillsammans. Score.
Ah, taxi record.
Hey, well, I'm ready.
Well, let's have a drink then, Andrew. Although, as I say, I'm probably not.
So what are the two varieties of drink we have? This is the schnapps.
Yeah, these are the schnapps. And that's called beska. Bitter drops.
Bitter drops. Oh.
You try it.
Rob pouring a nice little shot there. Very elegantly done. Let's go.
Skål.
Skål.
Yeah, that's basically I've had basically a bottle of schnapps there.
That is really, really bitter.
Mm. It is.
That is.
Yeah,
that
yeah, that's the worst one. I wouldn't drink that one.
Right, well, I need to go home. So that, right. Thanks
so
for...
Give me some beer to...
So does it get better? You can give me some beer now. Okay.
Yeah,
this
so this is a Swedish ale. It's called Control Alt Delete. And then here's
Control,
a log.
Control Alt Delete?
Yeah.
That's presumably a very ancient traditional name.
I'm trying to modernise it.
I'm going to have God's Lager. Yeah. So, Andrew Skoll, let's wash away the bitter, okay. The bitter drops with a
and
beer.
The nice salty leg juice as well.
I didn't really know what that tastes like after the schnapps.
No, it's good. It's good. It's soothing. See, I can see why you'd need a beer and then another drink, and then it's you're in a bit of a rotor.
You're on a bit of a rotor.
Two things are a bit kind of shocking, so you need the beer afterwards to kind of.
Yeah, exactly. To come down. We've got some breads here as well, Mimi. What have we got? We've got some.
This is a crisp bread. That's really. Call it knäckebröd in Swedish.
Oh, knäckebröd.
It's really here. Have
See, fun. That looks good. That looks like it might soak up. Do you think that might soak up? It doesn't look like it's going to soak up that much of the booze, Andrew, is it? And I've got this idea that they happen in sort of very bucolic places on the edges of lakes and rivers and all the rest of it. But presumably there's other big public ones in towns. Is it like in England everyone has a bonfire night? Is it like everyone has a every town has a big crayfish party, a public one?
No, I don't. I'm sure there are towns in Sweden, like smaller towns, or. Like we have at the Stockholm Deli and Restaurant, that we have our crayfish for people to come and have their party.
But there's carnage in front of us. There's
there
like
is sort of carnage.
Bodies ripped apart.
There are. There's neckabrod.
No cheese, though. And some very smelly fingers, Rob, for the rest
fingers.
Of the
Luckily, we've got our bibs on, which is, we should say, the illustration on it. It looks a little bit Christmassy, but it's also a crayfish lighting a firework or a candle.
While wearing a top hat.
Obviously, while wearing a top hat and a bow tie. We should say to Mimi Viktor, thank you so much for inviting us to our own crayfish party, I suppose. We're going to come down. Where's the restaurant? Where can we go and have round two?
The restaurant is on Sheen Lane, close to Richmond Park.
Oh, okay, you're down there. Yeah.
Like
okay,
Mold
cool.
Lake train
we'll come and hassle you for some bigger claws, right? for the time being, thank you very much. Tack så mycket.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
From market to table, the history of Sicily can be interpreted through its rich cuisine. Monocle Films traces the island's past with a tasty visit to a hands-on cooking school.
It's not so much about the recipe, but it's exactly about an experience. My dream is to offer to the people who come here an experience of a style of life that starts from the soil and arrives to the table.
A Taste of Sicily in the film's menu on monocle.com.
And welcome back to the Monocle Weekly with me, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound.
Glenn Campbell, Leon Russell, Hal Blaine, Carol Kaye, Tommy Tedesco, and Earl Palmer. Ring any bells? No? These are the names behind some of the most iconic guitar riffs, walking bass lines, piano harmonies, and rolling drum beats that helped bring a wave of pop music from Los Angeles to the public's attention in 1960s America.
This gang of session musicians were known as the Wrecking Crew and made their collective name on the hit records of everybody from the Beach Boys, Sonny and Cher, the Righteous Brothers, the Monkees and the Mamas and Papas. They're also the subject of a new documentary, 15 Years in the Making, by Denny Tedesco, son of the guitarist of the group, Tommy. Denny joins us now from New York. Thank you for coming on the programme, Denny.
Oh, thank you.
We've been watching the run-up to this film because you're still raising funds for it. So what's the status of the film at the moment?
The film is totally made. The only correction I have on the opening that you said, it's actually 17 years. So, they call it labor of love. It means no one else was helping you.
The Wrecking Crew that you show, it seems to be 20 roughly session musicians who appeared on everyone's records. How did you know, obviously, your dad's connection, but did you meet these people? How did you know about their stories?
Well, growing up, my dad was Tommy Tedesco, and as a guitar player, my dad went to work like any other dad. The only difference I always say is instead of a saw or a hammer, he had a, six string, and he had a mandolin and a banjo and maybe a Telecaster and amp in the car. But I never met anybody. I really did. I mean, dad went to work literally 12, 14 hours a day. He'd come home. I knew what he did, but it didn't mean much because that's all I knew what he did. You know, I didn't know he was, you know, making hits the what I thought he was doing. You know, didn't mean much until later in '70s when he started doing his own work. I didn't see my dad play guitar until probably about 1976 at home. Can you imagine? I mean, I'm born in 1961, but dad never brought the guitar home. That was work to him.
That's a really strange thing, Denny. I mean, the records that your dad and his group played on, or this sort of engine room of session musicians played on, laid down some of the most classic licks, some of the most classic sort of bass lines as well in pop history. Why didn't he bring his work home? I mean, I guess maybe at the beginning there was an idea that pop music or rock and roll was a fad, but by the early 70s, he must have been making some money and he must have been kind of a star on the session circuit.
Yeah, he was a huge star by then in the circuit, but it wasn't a personal, like, I'm not bringing this stuff home. It was like, you work 12 hours, you don't want to listen to music. And, you know, as the guy said, you didn't have to practice. You're playing 12 hours all day long. And you're not just playing, you're playing, someone's throwing music at you three or four different dates that day, different music all day. So it's like your chops are so good. It's like if you were playing, you know, a sport, you know, basketball or soccer or football, whatever, you're going to be that good if you play that long. You know, it was just, you know, he wanted to come home, spend time with the family and gamble and, you know, have fun. She'll find the note I left hanging
on her door. And one of the first big gigs I played was with the Doors. I got up there and I said, where's the band? They said, we ain't got no band, it's just you and the guitar. I went out with my guitar and opened for the Doors in Portland and Seattle. When I got back to town, I said, don't book me on no money of those, man. I said, I'll stay here and do sessions. I can make more money and enjoy it a hell of a lot more than going out there playing, trying to do, there is someone walking behind you. We want the Doors! Who's the guy with the lead singer? Bring Fassel out, you know. Through cupped hands round the tin can, I
pretend to hold you to my breast and find. What was your kind of view by the time the film kind of was almost put together? Did you think that these people were, you know, as you say, just doing a job and they kind of got the recognition they deserved at the time? Or did you sometimes look at the stars of that period and think, oh my gosh, these people didn't really have much talent? You know, it was the likes of my dad that made their careers.
Oh, you know what? The whole film, the basis of the film was, you know, how it started was in 96, was my father was diagnosed with cancer. And they gave him a year, and I thought, oh, God. You know, I always talked about doing the story. I was a filmmaker, and I thought, if I don't do it, you know, it's going to be the biggest regret in your life. So I basically put four of them together and started filming, you know, two dollies and a camera, and just started going for it. You know, my dad never got to see anything. He passed away, like, in 97. But I started just building footage and started interviewing people. And people would say, you know what, this is great, but you got to be honest. No one's going to come to the table because there's so much music. There's over 120 songs and you know 118. I mean, can you imagine? We're talking about Be My Baby, Good Vibrations, Frank Sinatra's Strangers in the Night. You know, they did Elvis, they did Sinatra, they did Phil Spector's Wall of Sound, Mamas and Papas, Fifth Dimension. Anything that was in Los Angeles in the 60s and in early 70s probably had some of these guys, if not all of them, on it. And that was just because the business itself was a business and some of the younger groups just didn't have the chops in the recording studio. And because rock and roll in 1960 was still it's only a few years old. Labels aren't trusting those rock and roll groups to go in there. They're going to blow it. You know, they only have one track. So it was a business, and they wanted to make sure they bet on the best. And what they would do is get these session musicians. You guys do the playing, they do the singing. And that's why Pet Sounds, Brian Wilson, used these guys. It was easier for him to lay down the stuff for them instead of his brothers and cousins.
And it's, there's such disparate records, Denny, playing on Sinatra, Strangers in the Night, to Pet Sounds, which really pushed a lot of boundaries in terms of the production, the instruments, the syncopation, all the rest of it. Is that something that you feel has changed in the music industry? Is that you're a rock band, you play rock music, you can't use jazz signatures, you don't mess stuff up. These guys were obviously amazingly tight, but do you think that's changed the way people play?
That was a great comment because Jimmy Webb, the great writer, you know, did so many things for Glenn and Fifth Dimension, all those great hits. He said something that was really ironic. He said, listen, when I was growing up on a farm, he says, in the 50s, he says, I was listening to two radio stations. That's all we had. We didn't have many choices. So those radio stations, what you ended up listening to, you could be listening to Ray Charles, you could be listening to Nashville country hit, you could be listening to Sinatra, or, you know, maybe whatever the rock group was at the time. He said there was, he said music today is segregated. So we were influenced by everybody. We were listening to everything. And he said, nowadays, you know, you're basically, you're rap, you're rock, you're this, you're independent, whatever it is, you're electronic, and that's missing. And he said, the other problem is, as we the musicians know these days, in those days, they had no choice, but they had to be in a room together. Glenn Campbell said, he said, I was playing with Michael Jordan, the great basketball player, but everybody in that room was a Michael Jordan. He says, because if you couldn't keep up with all of us, you weren't going to come back. You had 3 or 4 hours. You had, no, not 3 or 4 hours. You had 3 hours and you had to nail 3 or 4 songs. And then you move on to the next recording session. If you couldn't do that, you're not going to play with the big boys. It was just because, and they had to nail it because they only had one track. So there wasn't a lot of bouncing around as they, you know, with Pro Tools and all these other things. And now what happens is you lay down the drum track, you lay down the bass track, and everybody follows in line. The producers are putting it together. But what they aren't doing is they're not influencing each other. They're not in the room together. So they don't actually, sometimes they can't change anything because they can't influence each other. So that's a big deal that's missing.
One of the interesting things is, I guess when I'm in my kind of naivety, when I thought of the 60s, I imagined that the women who were in the studio were probably either the stars or the backing singers, and that all the session musicians would be guys. But in fact, that wasn't the case, was it?
No, Carole Kaye was a guitar player and a bass player. As they said, you know what, we never looked at her as a woman. She was a bass player. And that actually says more to me about them and her being in that studio at the time. When I just said no one was there unless they could play. If, you know, Carole is in bass and drums are the first thing that they would have replaced in a band if there was a weakness, because they're the ones driving. They're the driving force. So Hal and Earl Palmer, they are the driving force. And then the bass player, it could have been Carole or Joe Osborne. And for Carole to be there says a lot, because you know what? They looked at her strictly as a bass player, and she was exactly what she was, awesome musician.
We were recording I Saw Her Again last night, and Lou was the producer and I was the engineer, and we were punching vocals in, and we came to that part where the rhythm stops and the group goes, I saw her again last night. So, and I just punched in early. We were doing vocal, we got to do it over, we've done, I punched in early, they came in early, and so we stopped, and then we went back and started again. And I punched in at the beginning of the vocal when they started, you know, 2 bars later or whatever it was. And when I played it back, the vocal went, I saw her again. It was a mistaken punch. And Lou said, I love it, leave it in.
Denny, one last one for you. People will be familiar with Glenn Campbell, probably Leon Russell names in the band, went on to do other things. Glenn Campbell obviously famously had a big solo career, wrote for himself and other people wrote for him. What do you think it's like being in that tight group of very tight musicians, the Wrecking Crew? Did your dad have aspirations to go and have a solo career of his own, or was the money great, the people he hung out with great, and the tunes he got to play on amazing enough to just sustain his curiosity for his career?
Well, that's a really good question on that, because as far as my dad was concerned, you know, he was very lucky to even be a musician, professional musician. It was all by accident. He was in 1920 at a dance in Niagara Falls, New York, and the big band was losing the guitar player. And someone said, well, my friend plays guitar, and he tried out. Well, he tried out, got in the band, he traveled to Los Angeles, went, oh, this is pretty cool here. My dad wasn't working. He had no aspirations to do anything. And when he got to Los Angeles, he realized this could be fun and moved to Los Angeles and found a career. But he was a jazz guy. Most of these guys were from the jazz era. He would have wanted to be the jazz guy. He had so many influences, Charlie Parker, even as a guitar player, Bill Evans, piano But he won, you know, that was his love. But he also, he knew what it was. It was music. And there was, he said, there's music and there's the music business. Sometimes they mix, not always. So if you're doing a gig and you're getting paid, you do what the session wants or the leader wants or producer or artist want. He says, I play for smiles. If the guy's not smiling, I'm not nailing it. And that's going to get me back the next time. So he knew exactly how to work. He was happy to be paid for what he did. You know, and people say, well, why didn't, you know, should they have gotten more money? You know, in terms of like, hey, they wrote the opening licks or they did this or they did that. And he said, no. He said, you're not going to hold back creativity. You can't. That's not what you're there for. He said, I made hundreds of hits, but I made thousands of bombs. He says, I never gave back anybody his money. So it's just what it is.
All right, Denny. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Playing for smiles should be the mantra on the back of many a rock and roll T-shirt. I think that was Denny Tedesco. We should mention your Kickstarter campaign to get the last few grand for putting the Wrecking Crew together, or should we say putting the, getting the music to put over the film together, because clearly that has to be there. And that was Denny Tedesco, director of documentary The Wrecking Crew. Thank you for joining us on the line for New York City. Up next, we'll have a famous track from a famous session musician. And I lied before when I said we're going to have a famous track from a famous session musician. Booker T is a star in his own right, but he was a big session musician for all the legends in the 1960s. He has a new record out called Sound the Alarm, where he hangs out with various luminaries of the current scene like Mayor Hawthorne. This is from it. This is called Broken Heart, and it's with Jay James. This is Booker T. That was Booker T with Broken Up from the new record Sound the Alarm, and you're tuned in to the Monocle Weekly.
Well, and that's all for edition 215 of the Monocle Weekly, Rob.
I like that show, it was good. The crowfish bit in the middle.
Yes.
Have you washed your hands?
It still lingers, though. I have washed my hands.
Yeah.
I've still got, I've got little salty legs all over my fingers.
I know, exactly. The Schnapps, how are you feeling after that? I'm kind of feeling like it's kind of going to get my afternoon off to a great start.
Press Alt Delete was also a strange name for a beer.
Control Alt Delete.
Control Alt Delete.
Yeah, exactly.
I've even changed the name of that.
But that was a good thing. Steve's chat with Jimmy Wells is good. That's a good guest to get as well, isn't it? Interesting cat.
And apparently he spends a lot of time living in London.
We should get him. We should get him around here.
Maybe I'll look up his Wikipedia entry to see if that's a fact or not. To see if there's a citation.
You could always change it.
Yeah, I could do.
He spends most of his time in Chipping Sodbury.
Well, we don't know if we're here together next week, Rob, but two people will be in these seats, I guess.
Exactly. And today's show, whoever's next here next week, might be produced by them as well. Today's show is produced and researched by Marcus Hippie and Anna John. Our studio manager was, of course, Jack Phillips. We'll be here again, will we? Who knows? Same time next week. It's goodbye from me, Robert Bounds.
And from me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.